We are back live in the clubhouse, part two. Gil Hodges with Danny Perry and Art Chamsky.
Okay, my final thing before opening up. You were in right field for third game World Series. Tommy Agee makes two unbelievable catches. You were the closest to him on the second one for sure. What was your eyewitness? What are your memories as an eyewitness today?
He made two great plays, and there was a lot of great plays in that series. Of course, Ronnie Sepulveda made that wonderful catch, and Ed Charles made some great plays. Brooks Robinson had a great series in third. There was some wonderful defensive plays in that whole series, but before Tommy passed away, too young, too soon, I used to tell him all the time, I said, you know, Tommy, I was in right field. You made an easy play look hard, and you made so much money and fortune after made that play. And we used to joke about it, but he made two great catches. The one to the left where the ball almost comes down, and the one to the right he dives for, and he was a terrific player. And I just kept telling him he had plenty of room.
Very nice. Hodges said that the second time he aged a catch, where he just reached for the ball that was being, I guess, blown by the wind a little bit, and caught it off the ground. He said that was the greatest World Series catch he
had. That was the one that Paul Blair hit.
He ever saw. Yeah, just unbelievable. I was at the University of Wisconsin, and we were watching all the Mets games in the Student Union, and I was just saying how the Mets, those plays, every time AG made a great play, Sepulveda made a great play, the Mets just won. They just got new fans all over the country. You know, I just, you know, couldn't wait for the next game, and everybody in the country became a Mets fan.
Well, it was a great year for New York. Yeah. The Jets won, we won, and then the Knicks won in May of 70. It's a wonderful time for baseball and sports in New York at the time. It was kind of a lousy time in the city and the country and the world. But
one of my in my bibliography, I have Art's book, Magnificent Seasons, which you write about not just the Mets, but the Knicks and the Jets, and how they all won and galvanized the whole sports community in New York. And it was just an unbelievable era.
It was a great time for, like I said,
underdogs.
Sports. Yeah, all of us were underdogs.
And
it's most interesting, people tend to forget that none of the teams had ever won before.
Yeah.
The Knicks had never won. The Jets haven't won since. And the Mets, of course, won in 86 again. But it was
magic.
It was magic, and it was a great time for professional sports.
Questions for... No? Yeah, go ahead.
Two questions. The two incidents with Cleveland Jones, the shoe polish incident, was it real? Did it happen?
it really happened because...
I can tell you it's in the book, and Art can say his version. You want to do that?
We'll say what you do, what you...
I had to word it so Joan Hodges wouldn't be upset, but she'll probably be upset anyway.
If you could just give an intro to what this is.
I guess it's the final game. Is that the...
Was it the final game?
Yeah.
Was it game
yeah,
five?
Yeah, about sixth inning or something. Cleon Jones. The thing people forget is Frank Robinson was hit the inning before, oddly enough, and the umpire Lee DeMuro said he wasn't hit.
Lee
it's
DeMuro,
like the worst umpire umpiring for two innings we've ever had. Or anyway, Cleon Jones gets hit by a pitch. The ball bounces off his shoe. This is the way I remember. You can get the real way after. And the ball went all the way into the dugout. Now, Cleon Jones says the ball did hit my shoe. So that, and I guess he's not lying. But anyway, Ed Kringpool told us that there was a bag of balls in the dugout, and all of them had scum. They were all scum. And that Hodges very quickly said, Ed, give me a ball. I also talked to Jerry Kuzman. His version is that Kuzman ended up with a ball when it rolled in, and Hodges said, rub the ball on your shoe to get it on. Now, Kuzman wouldn't admit to this until about 1993, so this many years went by that he had scuffed the ball, and he told Peter Golan that for his book. But so I wanted the newer version. So he told. So I'm telling him, okay, maybe could it possibly have been that it was scuffed, but there wasn't enough on it, and Hodges just said, why don't you add to it by scuffing it? So Kuzman said, yeah, let's say it that way, because that sort of gets Hodges off, because Hodges is the guy with the most integrity of anybody
in the history
of baseball. And, you know, Hodges, for people who don't know, then took the ball, went out, showed the umpire the marking, and he sends Cleon Jones to first base, yeah. And then, well, good stuff.
Cleon didn't start walking to first base right away, and so Clendenin always said, "Well, go to first." You know, most, you know, and that all scenario happened. But the truth be whatever it be, you know, and folklore or whatever it is, it worked and we won the World Series. But I really don't know, quite honestly, the real truth, because we're hearing different stories from Crane, Poole, Kuzman. I think the only person that really knows at this point is Cleon, and he also doesn't know the.
Yeah, but Cleon wasn't in the dugout.
Yeah, no, in the dugout. Yeah, but I mean whether it hit him or not. But the reality of it is that whatever happened worked out for him.
It's good he didn't come out with two balls.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have really confused me. but that was a great moment.
The other question is also with Cleon.
I was in right field at this time. For all of those of you who remember this incident where a ball was hit down in the left field line and we were getting beat really bad in the second game of the doubleheader in Houston. I can even
after being slaughtered in the first game.
Yeah, we really got beat bad. We were not playing good baseball. And I can tell you, if I remember correctly, Johnny Edwards was the guy who hit the ball down the left field line. He was a teammate of mine with the Reds, a catcher. And Cleon kind of loafed after it a little bit, and I'm in right field. And Gil, when he would come out from the dugout, never stepped on the first base line. He was very superstitious, and I had great eyes at that time. I could see almost the writing on the baseball from the right outfield. And he came out to the mound when the play was over. Edwards ended up at second. We're getting beat really bad second game after the first game. And he walks out to the mound, and I'm thinking he's going to change pitchers. And he walks by the pitcher towards shortstop, and I said, "Oh, what the hell did Buddy do?" He walked by Buddy, and I said to myself, "Cleon, if I were you, I would run right towards that left field bullpen and just ask him to open that door and get out of there." And Cleon, to this day, says that Gil just asked him if his leg, how's he feeling, and Cleon said he hurt his leg in Montreal when we had played a couple nights before, and just basically took him out of the game and walked back to the dugout. That was really a turning point for the season. Whether it's coincidence or not, we started to play a lot better. But that was Gil at his best. Not a man of many words. He went out there, whatever he said to Cleon, short and brief. Cleon walked back to the field. Somebody was close out there, and from that moment on, it was a different story for the New York Mets.
And that moment on, every player knew that if they didn't hustle, we might have a manager walk out on the field and take him out with him.
You didn't want him to do it.
More questions for Art?
A giant boy from back here, and it relates to your book, Danny.
Yeah.
And Art was obviously there when it happened. Our first two-time author who was here, you may know, Tim Wendell, wrote a book, Summer of 68, which is a fantastic book that you are looking for another great book to read. And it's about the Tigers-Cardinals World Series, but it's really about everything that happened in 1968. And one of the stories is, after Bobby Kennedy's assassination, Gil Hodges, and what happened with the Mets. There were a lot going on with all the teams, obviously, how to make decisions about what to do, whether to play or not, but if both of you could really just talk about that.
Well, in the book, the story is that Bobby Kennedy died and they canceled games in Washington and New York and not everywhere else. And the Mets were scheduled to play in San Francisco, which had a bat day promotion. So San Francisco Giants really wanted the Mets to play. But I guess Crane Poole was the instigator, and he just said that he thought it was really disrespectful to have the assassination of U.S. Senator from New York, which Bobby Kennedy was, in play, and Hodges went along with it. He just basically said, you know, don't go out carousing or anything. You know, I'm going to go to church myself, and the rest of you, you know, just keep it low key, whatever you do. And I guess I will continue the question that Jay started. In the book, and I think George Vesey is who I quote, he said this was a bonding moment for the team and Gil Hodges.
Yeah, there was no doubt about it that was another moment. There was were some key moments that changed all our lives, that was one of them. Those years.
But did you respect Hodges for his stance there?
I always respected Gil. I never saw Gil just in a separate. You never say no for an autograph. Was very accommodating to people and fans. But Gil was, as we all kind of got to know him a little better, although I must honestly say I never really knew him. But as I played for him, and much respected him just for being the kind of believer in people and the way he handled people and the way he dealt with situations. I wasn't used to that. I played for managers that were all over the place. And, you know, Gil sat back. I heard you mention before that he was Walter Alston, very typical of Walter Alston, sitting back, making a move here and there. And he, I think all of us gained a lot of respect for him from the moment we met him and learned that he was a no-nonsense kind of guy and that wherever was going to take to win ball games, whatever Mets had done in the past, was not going to be tolerated. That's not to say in 68 we didn't play bad, because we played bad in 68 and the beginning of 69. But there was not a lot of tolerance for that. And you weren't around and you didn't play if you continued to do those kind of things. And I think his ability to use the whole bench, because he understood that over the course of the year, you're going to need that 24th and 25th and 23rd player. And then he had the presence of mind to know that whatever combination he put out there was able to do whatever they could do. And I think out of that, we all were able to build foundations to have decent years. And if you look at Svoboda and my year together in right field, it turned out to really be a good year. And even first base with Clendenin and Crankle. But all of us over the years when we first met Gil were taken by him in the sense that he was a guy that was no nonsense, total respect from his players. And I think
Did you realize that even more years later?
Yes. I think we played for Gil, and all the things I'm saying now were part of our playing for him, but as you know, when he passed away and years later, as we see the significance of that team. You know, I played 13 years, and most people around him never asked me about the other 12. It's about 1969, and as the folklore about that team and as the legacy goes on, it's about Gil Hodges and all of us who are part of this team. And when you talk about it, it's not only about Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman, it's about Al Weiss and Kenny Boswell and Jerry Grody and J.C. Martin. It's about everybody who contributed to that team. And I think Gil, of course, will be always known as the leader of that team. And I've always said this. I always thought managers really didn't deserve a lot of credit and got too much credit for winning and not enough for losing. But in this case, I think Gil was really the catalyst that held this team together and really kind of kicked us in the rear, and I don't mean that literally. I mean he kicked us in the rear to be able to play better and to understand that the game had to be played better. You know, the Mets were lovable losers for so many years, and I know that playing against them. And so he demanded more, and he got more. And again, I think if he would have lived longer, they would have won more championships. They could have won in 73 with Yogi, but the reality of his skill was such a steadying force that I think that would have, he would have demanded stuff, and I think that would have happened. And I don't know if in our lifetime we'll see him in the Hall of Fame, but
yes, we will, right?
I hope so. I hope so for Mrs. Hodges' sake and Gil, his son's sake, and the daughter's. But he certainly deserves it. I played against some of the guys who are in there who have basically the same similar stats, and it's just amazes me. Again, I don't want to begrudge anybody for being in there, but you have somebody who had his career, his importance to an organization, and it just boggles my mind that he's not in there. It is what it is.
Art, did he change in 70 or in 169, or did the players change, or?
No. He was the same in 70. We didn't win in 70. The National League at the time, and particularly the National League East, was a very tough division. Some guys just didn't have the years they had the year before, but he didn't change. There was always going to be this guy that sat back, made moves, did what he did, and very stern, tough guy. But I will say this, and I don't want to make it sound like you couldn't talk to him if you had a problem. He had something to say about it. I can give you a perfect example. I don't know how much time we got. Do we have a few more minutes?
We have time.
In 1969, in September, I took off for the Jewish holidays. I was torn between this decision because we were fighting for the division. We were fighting for some recognition. We had been a bad team for so many years, and now we've got a chance to really accomplish it. I didn't know what to do. We were in Pittsburgh, and I couldn't do it without talking to Gil. And as I mentioned before, I never really had a lot of conversations with him. It's a guy that you went and looked to see if your name was in the lineup, and if it was there, you were happy. If it wasn't, it was what it was. But so I went up to him and I said, "Gil, can I talk to you for a minute?" He said, "Sure, what is it?" She ran right off the bat, made me feel a lot better. And I said, "Gil, I'm really toying with this taking off for the Jewish holidays." And he said, very, very quickly, he said, "Well, you do what you think is best for you." And it made me feel terrific. And we were playing a doubleheader in Pittsburgh, and it was a big decision for me because I felt I was going to be playing and I was having a good year. And so I did it. We ended up winning both games with a doubleheader, 1-0. It's a very famous day in that year because both starting pitchers were winning runs. So, but it took a lot of pressure off me by us winning. But that moment that I had that conversation with me, and in some sense changed my life and my whole feelings about my relationship with Gil, because I knew at that moment that if I had a problem, whether I kind of avoided him rest of the year or not, if I had a problem, I could go to Gil and he would talk to me like somebody that understood the situation, and my relationship at that point changed. I wasn't that much more friendly with him as than the years went on, but I had total respect for him and felt like he was a guy that I could talk to if I had needed to talk to him. And I think everybody on that team that played for him over the years felt that they could do that. Gil was a guy that looked you right in the eye and told you. And if I would have said to him, "Gil, I want to play more. Why aren't I playing more?" He would have told me, and nothing would have changed. I wouldn't have. But he was certainly set in his ways. But I think if you had to have a situation with him, you could always talk to him. And there wasn't a lot of managers that I always felt that about. But Gil was and I hope his legacy continues, because he certainly was one of the key figures in the history of baseball and sports in New York City, as a player and as a manager, and it'll be a shame if he doesn't make the Hall of Fame, but it certainly won't, in my mind, it won't hurt his image as a person, as a ball player, and as a manager.
Yeah, it's really good. Well spoken. I have another person here today, Dave Kaminer, who's a great family friend, I'd like him to address one thing. Gil, I don't know if Gil is a Democrat, partly because his father was a miner and the Democrats were more sympathetic. But he never talked about politics, even to his family. And he never talked, and this was during the 60s. And Dave, who's a family friend and was a writer, got to know Gil really well, and I just love the story of you and when he was almost sent into the Army. So can you just...
Let me say one thing first. I grew up as a Gil Hodges fan, became a writer, became a Gil Hodges friend, But up until tonight, I never realized that Art had kept Pete Rose, Tony Perez, and Gil out of the Hall of Fame. You're the reason. I had been drafted in 68, the height of Vietnam, and left where I was, wrote Gil a note, said, don't know where I'm going to be, but I'm going in to the service the day before your first home game. And he wrote back to me, you know, and I report, right, 39 Whitehall Street, not too far from here, scared like hell that I'm going to be a Jewish Marine. And they wound up sending me home, found something wrong with my ankle. I'm not even Jason Bay. And the next day, I'm at the ballpark, and I'm covering, and he looks over, it's his first game managing the Mets in New York, and he looks over and he mouths me, what are you doing? Stay there. And he finishes what he's doing, comes over to me, asks me what happened, puts his arm around me, and this is Pets Marine. He was terrific. He really was a terrific man. And in a day and age when we don't know if our heroes are worth the adulation we give them, what they're taking, what they're not taking, Gil Hodges was everything we ever wanted him to be as fans, as teammates, as guys who played for him. I'll tell you one story, I know it's late. This is it. I spoke to Gil Jr. on the way here tonight. He's down his sister's ill in Florida, and he's with her. But in 69, when Clendenin came home, Clendenin was an interesting man. He played for Gene Moff. And Gil Jr. was then a college player playing for CW Post. And he had permission from the league through his dad to travel with the team, take batting practice, take hitting practice. And one day he's in the clubhouse, and Clendenin comes over to him. He looks at him and says, but this is not the book. I'm going to tell you the story.
I know the story.
You know the story.
I know the story.
So, do you ever challenge your old man? And do you know the story?
No.
And Gilly looks at Clinton and says, no. He says, you're not a man until you challenge your father. And Gilly didn't know what to say. With that, Rube Walker standing there. He looks at Clinton and he says, you're such a man, you challenge him. And that was the end of that. Yeah. Never brought up again. Yeah. He was really terrific to the writers. Didn't say much. Really didn't say much. But what he said was true. He was honest. And he really was. I mean, if we still had our beers, I'd say, let's toast him. He was belongs in the Hall of Fame. There are theories that Jack Lang, who was the secretary and treasurer of the Baseball Writers Association, a very powerful guy within the family of baseball writers, was the only guy Gil did not get along with in his career. And when Jack Lang died, I heard about it. My son, Gil, who's been for Gil, calls me, tells me, Dad, Gil was working with him. Jack Lang has just passed. So I immediately get on the phone and call Gil Jr. And he says to me, I hope they bury him in that blue sport jacket. He had a horn jacket that he wore forever. There's also the Ted Williams theory, which Danny writes about. The book is, have many of you finished the book or started the book? The book is wonderful. The book is absolutely wonderful. I was reading it, and my girlfriend kept saying, have you finished? I said, no, I don't want to finish it. He dies in the end. And I got, I'm sitting there, the chair that I read, reading the end of the book, and I'm crying. And I remember vividly being at the funeral, Piggy taking me to see the body. I was in Houston on Easter Sunday, and I got a call. I was just, he was a bigger-than-life guy. And many of you were young, and you don't remember when he passed away. It shook this city like nothing you can believe. I came out of the church. Gil was offered, the family was offered St. Patrick's. And the decision was, no, it's going to be at Our Lady Help of Christians, which is where Gil went to Mass every Sunday. And I went to the church. Jackie Robinson sitting right in front of the church. Quite congested. It's 40 years ago. And when the Mass was over, and the doors opened, there must have been 10,000 people on the street. It was as if it was a mafia funeral. All you could see were people in Brooklyn. And he was such a beloved figure. It bothers me, and it bothers everybody who knew him, or who wanted to know him and who loved him from afar, that he's not in the Hall of Fame. We just can't figure it. And sitting next to one more thing, and that's it. With a four home run man here, I believe Gil is the only guy who hit four home runs in one game
all four different pitchers. Am I correct?
Yeah, two left-handers, two right-handers.
Yeah, four different pitchers, one hit, which is pretty remarkable.
And he got a single.
In Boston, am I correct?
At Carl, against the Braves, yeah. Right. Carl Erskine was the pitcher and got four singles himself. You know, the only time he ever got four singles. So they posed together, both holding four. One with four homers and one with four singles.
Some of it went to the Hofstra University had an event this year looking at the 50 years of the Mets. And they did an academic conference for 3 days. And it became a Gil Hodges love it. It really did.
Well, you probably heard that he said it very quickly, but Dave's son, his name, Gil, after Gil Hodges, across, there's so many people named Gil Hodges. He had that impact on people who knew him and who didn't know him.
But who wanted to know him.
He's a unique fellow, and it was very interesting and enlightening doing this book about this guy. You know, I did the book on Roger Maris, and there wasn't universal praise for the man himself. He was miserably treated by the reporters of New York and elsewhere, and his reputation was ruined. But Gil Hodges, everybody likes Gil Hodges. So
everybody. The book that came out a couple of years ago, Go Home and Pray for Gil Hodges, which was fraught with errors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Including the fact that he was in the lineup on Jackie Robinson's first game. He was not on the
April 15th, 1947.
He was not on the roster that day. He was in the lineup. But in that book, he's on the field. Oh,
well. Any more questions? We have three people now on here. Is that it? Anyway, thank you so much for
just to close for now, first I'd like to thank Danny Perry very much for this terrific evening and wonderful book. Once again, for those of you listening, the book is called Gil Hodges, The Brooklyn Bums, The Miracle Mets, and The Extraordinary Life of a Baseball Legend by Tom Clavin and Danny Perry. You can pick this up anywhere. For those of you in the clubhouse, the lovely Netta in the Met orange shirt will be selling the books right now. And to close, I'd like to have Art give us the last word on something that he's doing, continuing on the great history of the New York Mets and baseball through this city.
Thank you. I'm in the middle of a series of some baseball clinics I'm doing out at Randall's Island, tied into the Boys and Girls Club, and be able to help some of those kids do it. But it's also for adults. And if anybody's interested, Teresa will be able to give us some information. Take your number, we can do it. The next one is September 15th, and I'll probably do one at some point in October, so I'm busy with that. And it's a wonderful cause because we're, again, trying to help some of these kids. And as I'm not anybody can come to them, but whoever sponsors can also know that they're doing something good for the Boys and Girls Club. And the other thing I'm really involved with now is Israel's effort to get into the World Baseball Classic. Anybody know what they'll be in a pre-tournament in September. I've been named, for what it's worth, the ambassador to baseball for the Israel Association of Baseball. And I'm really excited about doing that because I managed there in 2007 when they did the Israel Baseball League. And so I'll be down there in Jupiter, Florida, while they try to advance and get through this tournament. And I think it's the week of September 19th, 20, 21, 22. So I'm busy with that, but the clinics now are something that I'm really involved with. So if anybody's interested in getting some information, we can get your number and send you some stuff. Teresa will get it there, okay? And anyway, thank you for inviting me. It was wonderful.